thank you, Jenny and Alex, and especially for the ventilation in this back room, which can be a little bit warm. But this is a piece of writing that I've been working on off and on for about 3 years, and I didn't really realize until, oh, this is videos. it's so nice to live with that. And I've been working on it for about 3 years off and on, and this summer I have to finish it just cause. So it started when I wrote an essay for Robert Gober's catalog called I Don't Remember. And I had written this whole other section of it that didn't make it into the book because of just the way it is. And so I took those few pages and then I just started to write really about a particular that particular time in New York. And as I wrote, I really realized that I was writing about the ways in which segregation had worked in the gay world then, and how Gary Fisher in particular had written about this in his diaries. It was very much a sexual excitement for him to be, you know, the sort of only black person in the situation, or one of very few. So he shows up in this piece, but mostly what you'll hear today has to do with this world that I grew up in and the people in it. Call me your nigger Proust. The artist does. It's 2012 or something like that. He's sitting across from me, his box filled with things I don't remember or half remember. Young, white, and thin, the artist is from the South, and blush making in his various kindnesses about what I have done and will do. The artist claims to be making a work of art based on my life or certain aspects of my life, evidence of which he has collected along the way without my knowing it. Photographs, manuscripts, and certain quotes such as this. In college, Hilton was our nigger Proust. The last the artist attributes to someone I knew in college, and her remark, so in keeping with her outre sense of herself, shocked and did not shock me. It was of a piece with the world I grew up in as a writer, 1980s and early 1990s queer New York. A world where class somehow got conflated with race and the ugly was considered beautiful because that was true to the spirit of New York then, and a power elite that would never call itself that while feeling free to call me anything. But I don't want to remember that. Joe Bernard wanted to remember, and I don't. In 1970, when the then 28-year-old artist and writer published his evocative book, I Remember, AIDS had yet to affect the gay world, Bernard describes with such fleeting delicacy in his collection of prose poems, short prose poems separated by white space, just as these reflections will be separated by white space. Bernard's white space is different than my own, though. He uses his sometimes as a pause and sometimes as a bridge where one can rest between reading one thought and then the next. What to call mine? The white space of grief? The dry white that fills the mouth right before the body is flooded with fear and sadness? Unlike Joe Bernard, who wrote unabashedly in I Remember of kissing men, boys in their underwear, small male feet, his cock and what made it happy. I am writing of bodies in a different way. I am writing of the world AIDS devoured, or more accurately, eviscerated, and from the point of view of a quote unquote survivor who hates that word. No person ever survives another person. We just wake up and make coffee and read the paper and check emails and think and have dinner, and then there it is, another day. I don't want to remember that Joe Bernard died of AIDS-related pneumonia in 1994. I don't want to remember that the acquired and acquired immune deficiency syndrome is the word many survivors attach themselves to in the first days and years of it. How did he or she get it? How did he or she acquire the thing that led to the stories no one wants to remember? I remember wondering why, if Jesus could cure sick people, why he didn't cure all sick people. Joe Bernard wrote about a third of the way through I Remember, a book that includes a number of similar questions, or should I say touching reflections on hope. Presumably Bernard's Jesus question occurred to him while he was still a kid, growing up in 1950s Tulsa, Oklahoma, with Ron Padgett, another burgeoning poet. And yet, it is a question as old as the soul. Why can't the ill be made whole? Why can't the intensity of our fixed, well-meaning gaze, as we stare down at the cracked lips, the white sheets barely covering the carposi, the dank hair, the sour toes, the what's behind your staring eyes, your hurt, your pill breath, what's behind, what's left of you. Why can't our wellness or Jesus make this right? Make the sick rise again like Jesus, hope restored to their eyes, and thus rehabilitated, married in a true, no city hall, ringless way. I don't want to remember that one reason I started to read I Remember, after many years of not being shut out of it, was to shut the contemporary world of men out, to drown out what they told me in bars now over dinner, casually on a New York City stroll, as if yesterday never happened. I know why X0 converted. It's like what happened to me. You meet a hot guy and shit goes down and you know, it just happens. It's okay to be scratched by the kitty. HIV is like, what, diabetes now? You can control it. Your doctor can control it, so why should I control what's natural to me? I don't want to remember that for a long time, from the time I was outed by my aunt, my father's sister, when I was a teenager through 1992, the year my most beloved friend died of AIDS, I thought of all gay people as one body, one with a shared history of laughter and mortification, visual bait in the grade school play yard, not to mention at the family dinner table, not to mention in those love affairs that were not merciful, and in such environments that encouraged love in toilets and over the telephone, in the dark, map rooms where one could not see the body electric because it was too dark, but on the reflection that was my hope for the gay body, that it would not obscure its ability to laugh, and through its various mortifications to be electric. A light in the dull world, illuminating those waters that would not cast that body out because it was strange and all. Elizabeth Bishop, rainbow, rainbow, rainbow. Looking back, I can see why I imagined queerness as a single entity. I had grown up with and in another body, a black body. That black body was for the most part poor, female, and spiritually husbandless, except for Jesus. Black men in America were too sad about themselves to stay in the family. No one knew why, but the world of love had forsaken that black female body early on, or passed it by as it bent over someone else's child or mess, wiping up both with charity and who could say what. But those various rejections and responsibilities were nothing compared to the changes that black body put itself through in order to accommodate all that. Why make anyone feel terribly? That body said without saying it, since to say it would mean saying I. That body could not say I because it did not speak that kind of language. Years passed, nature called, demanding that I feel now. Feel now, feel now. I was 15. When I closed my eyes and imagined the odors I wanted to rub up against, I didn't imagine the black body, but a queer one that would belong to me and I to it. I didn't know what that queer body looked like. I only knew I wanted it to feel differently from any other body I'd ever known. Unlike the black body, the queer body would not be left sick. It would not change its shape to accommodate someone else's feelings about what that body should be or what it made others feel. The queer body was not sad and felt now, felt now, felt now. It was electric with its own presence and sometimes got beneath the watery surface of every subconscious it came into contact with, even among those people who insisted on impersonating straight men and women, thus making the whole world Elizabeth Bishop, rainbow, rainbow, rainbow. Of course, none of this turned out to be true except in my imagination, and the only rainbow I saw in 1980s queer New York was the now ubiquitous LGBTQ rainbow flag designed by Gilbert Baker in 1978, a creation that was said to have been inspired by Over the Rainbow singer Judy Garland's signature tune. By the time I got to the queer body, it was kitsch. And its various male-dominated bars and societies were just as closed off and prejudicial as those people in societies who treated the black female body with such contempt, maybe more so to distinguish it from subjugation, from the feminine. One certainly felt that in many gay bars in the East Village. Those bars were, for the most part, dominated by white gay men who were active in ACT UP, or the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, founded by the author Larry Kramer in 1987. In any case, most of the ACT UP boys one encountered in those East Village bars were semiotically schooled warriors, who, in addition to having read Roland Barthes' A Lover's Discourse and Michel Foucault's Discipline and Punish, felt they knew something about the other. For the most part, their armor was pretty much the same. Baseball cap, jeans, black Doc Martens, bomber jacket, and withering taste. Draw an analogy between, quote, Jewish moral seriousness and homosexual aestheticism and irony as the dominant sensibilities in urban culture. Susan Sontag said in 1964, the reason for the flourishing of the aristocratic posture among homosexuals also seems parallel to the Jewish case. For every sensibility is self-serving to the group that promotes it. Homosexuals have pinned their integration into society on promoting the aesthetic sense. Susan Sontag's work and frequent presence on the New York scene, her meaning, was part of the conversation in those East Village bars, but I can't remember anyone pointing out that her essays and stories about gay aesthetics and politics, ranging from Notes on Camp to the end of her 1975 piece about Leni Riefenstahl, Fascinating Fascism, to 1986's The Way We Live Now, a story about AIDS, to 1991's AIDS and its metaphors were about the audience it was addressing, which is to say, white gay men who were given to a certain aristocratic posturing, much as Sontag herself was a, we do this, we don't do that, kind of person. What they didn't do was the black body. Unless, of course, it had a dick dipped in violence. Violence as transgression, the other side of cool, the not normative. In her posthumous 2012 book, As Consciousness is Harnessed to Flesh, Journals and Notebooks, 1964 to 1980, Sontag writes of a conversation she had with her former lover, the Cuban playwright, Marie Irene Fornes, February 23rd, 1977. Story Irene told me about being robbed and raped 4 years ago in her building as she was returning home about 1 a.m., getting into the elevator. A black man forced it open. She screamed, "If you scream again, I'll kill you." Took her to the 8th top floor and halfway upstairs leading to her roof. Then blindfolded her. I asked, "Did you get excited sexually?" She said yes, then said I was the first person she'd ever told that story to who'd asked her that. "But it's such an obvious question," I said. Sontag then goes on to relate how she phoned Fornes the next day to say how stupid Fornes' friends were for not asking the question. Then, quote, "I was thinking now it was because you told me it happened 4 years ago and you obviously were okay, not traumatized, talked about it so coolly, that it was easy to ask that." Did Fornes adopt her coolness in order to match, or rather preempt, Sontag's own coolness vis-a-vis bodies in general, and the other body in particular? Perhaps Fornes didn't want to suffer through Sontag's academic take on pain, and said she was turned on by that black abuse in order to get her former lover to shut up. But Fornes should have known better. Black anything generates more words in the liberal imagination. Or perhaps Fornes said she was turned on because she knew how her misfortune would play out in Susan Sontag's imagination, no matter what she said. Susan Sontag never publicly identified herself as a feminist, a soft cause. In any case, Sontag may have slept with women, but she revered the creative European male mind and body, particularly if that body was fucked up, a piece of crumpled paper filled with fragments separated by white space and the wrong words. The movement to de-establish the author has been at work for over 100 years. So begins Sontag's laudatory 1973 essay on Anton Artaud. Later in the piece, the author marvels at Artaud's outrageous self-destruction, his phenomenology of suffering. Sontag was less patient when it came to the American attitude towards body, writing in 1972 of her old friend, the author and philosopher Paul Goodman, and what remains his most famous book, 1960s Growing Up Absurd. The major defect of Growing Up Absurd, which purports to treat the problems of American youth, she wrote, is that it talks about youth as if it consists only of adolescent boys and young men. But it is precisely the world of men, European men, that Sontag looks up to in a great deal of her writing. Marie Irene Fornes was not male, but her rape put her in the company of those men that interested Sontag and made it another body in extremis, the author de-established by uncontrollable forces, just as Artaud had been by his visions and drugs and the ecstasy of degradation. In those bars, Roland Barthes was a sentimental favorite. His 1977 book, A Lover's Discourse, articulated what those boys knew about love, that it was tied up somehow with mother, and outside of her purview, the world was fragmented at best, a post that it didn't so much let the other in as encourage. I don't want to remember. The mirror hanging on the wall behind the bar at one or another of those East Village watering holes showed two faces, itself and itself. Itself had a hair and a complexion that was not unlike Roland Barthes' writing, particularly when he said stuff like, "I love you has no usages. Like a child's word, it enters into no social constraint. It can be a sublime, solemn, trivial word. It is a socially irresponsible word." But I didn't feel love was a socially irresponsible word. Indeed, what I was looking for in those bars was a little social responsibility, a contract where love was not a bargain and I was not a signifying anything, a love that did not get you anywhere, like joining ACT UP. Draped in my rainbow flag, I approached itself. He was leaning on the bar, facing the door. He was dressed in the uniform of the time, t-shirt, jeans, boots, self-conscious masculinity at war with itself. If it wasn't, then there would be no need for a uniform. Itself could be himself, but that wasn't the point. Being like the others was the point. Those others who thought love had to be trivialized because what they were really in love with was their resentment. Why weren't they real men with the perceived privileges of real men, taking as much, if not more, from a world that would give them as much, if not more, than they wanted, whenever they wanted to discard it. But that was not to be. There was AIDS, and if that didn't teach you your insignificant faggot ass something, what did? I know it wasn't right, Ma. What was I, an extension of your black body, doing in that bar, wrapped in rainbow, 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 trying to communicate something of myself to itself, who generally used race as his only leg up in a capozzi sick and diminished world. At least he wasn't black and gay, they thought, as powerless as that. But our black body couldn't help itself, ma. We saw love as a form of salvation. We could save or remake the stricken gay body with love, but we couldn't. It was feeding on itself to survive, so it could escape a presence not like ours. I think I stayed in those bars longer than I should have because I was frozen in my disbelief. How could these people live without hope and practically no belief that the world could be different? I was like my ma in this. I would change people with love and support and hope, and I would not leave until I had accomplished that. Weren't all gay men and women brothers and sisters? Wasn't blackness my body here? Eat of my body for sustenance. Here it is beneath this rainbow, this black body that finds itself, its value in watching the worst change for the better. Love would be waiting on the other side of all that, right, Ma? Just as there was love for you on the other side of what? As you lay bleeding still, and then dying, and then dead, full of hope, waiting for things to be different. By the time I hit those East Village bars in the mid-1980s, I was in my 20s. But even so, I had been waiting for things to be different for a long time by then. When I was 13 or 14, I was taken up by older gay men. I only had my body, and what those men gave me was language. Their style of speech reminded me, as I read and went on, of the sound of Frank O'Hara's poems, not to say person, a paradigmatic gay figure that was not unlike those bodies who condemned my body as a way of initiating me into their idea of brotherhood. Frank O'Hara's voice is overestimated by mediocre thinkers and memoirists who champion it, and like O'Hara, lack the discipline to write about things as they are other than themselves. But unlike the majority of his supporters, O'Hara knew that there was a larger world, having gone out into it through his imagination. Pity is, he felt most comfortable in the small, moneyed, and bohemian world that rewarded him for being frank. In his poems, which helped define the New York School of Poetry, O'Hara's voice is often arch, a put down begging to be put down. Indeed, most of the men I knew as a teenager had, like O'Hara, come of age as young queers in the 1950s, when archness, the better dressed sister to the irony I experienced in those bars, was the prevalent gay male attitude. From his 1964 verse poem, Lana Turner Has Collapsed. Lana Turner has collapsed. I was trotting along and suddenly it started raining and snowing, and you said it was hailing, and suddenly I see a headline, Lana Turner Has Collapsed. I had been to lots of parties and acted perfectly disgraceful, but I never actually collapsed. Oh, Lana Turner, we love you, get up. This was the voice of those men, and here was their mouth. This went on for years, and then there was AIDS. There was no time to recover from the gay male body that felt it was a thing that God couldn't cure, to visiting those dying bodies in the hospital that God couldn't cure. These questions weren't entirely rhetorical. Bodies in the hospital that God couldn't cure. In the midst of all this, one lost touch with one's own body. Would it be dead in a moment's notice? If not, who would be alive to love it? These questions weren't entirely rhetorical. But if you didn't care, love couldn't get at your body. You wouldn't let the wrong guy in, and he wouldn't seed you and become a part of your bloodstream forever. even after he was gone and your mother couldn't bear to be at your bedside, her only son dying, she couldn't do it, be there to swab your dry lips with a moist cloth as you climbed out of one fear to the next. You'd have to rely on friends for that kind of comfort, but it made him angry sometimes to have to be anywhere near you in that state, and what felt like all the time. Life was passing them by in a different way, and who told you to love in the first place? From Joe Bernard's, I remember when Negroes first started moving into white neighborhoods, how everyone got scared because if a Negro moved into your neighborhood, the value of your property would go down. Alvin was the scary Negro in the East Village bar I frequented. When I knew him in the late 1980s, I was in my late 20s. He was an older man, maybe in his 40s, short and powerful, with a thick and terrifying afro that looked like the platonic perfect cock, erect, thick, and terrifying. Alvin was the bouncer at the bar on East 4th Street. He didn't stand outside the establishment checking IDs, though. He acted as a kind of custodian in the truest sense of the word. Alvin reminded those white boys that they didn't own everything in sight, including him. I want to remember how Alvin would grab a boy by the short of the neck if he saw him taking up space inappropriately, putting his feet up on the banister, fucking around in one of the small bathrooms, getting drunk and rolling up in somebody's face, and tossed him out into the street. I want to remember Alvin's menacing silence and how he looked me in the eye, and I want to remember how he looked Carlos in the eye. Carlos was a Panamanian friend of mine. He was thick and round, a Botero figure without the Serapi or Lindsay. I met Carlos through some Queens we'd gone to college with. We didn't like them very much. Carlos had black, curly hair and a ready tongue, ready to kiss, ready to sing. For a time, he performed with the musician Meredith Monk. Carlos's tongue was also ready to lay any man flat who even thought they were his match in the elegant and not so elegant put down department. Alvin had a weakness for balls of oleo gleam, like Carlos. He melted in Carlos's presence. Even though they were involved with other people when they met, Alvin and Carlos quickly became lovers. And it was through Carlos that I learned Alvin had a life outside of that bar. He was a printer and a father, and he loved Carlos. Carlos, in turn, loved Alvin for a number of reasons, including the fact that Alvin could lift him off the ground like a sack of the sweetest something, no problem. I loved hearing about all that, just as I loved imagining the heat of their love making, Alvin's pillar of hair and Carlos's Indian blood curls soaked through and spread on the pillow. It was 1991, 1992, 1993. The world was one big hospital bed. Sometimes the sheets were dotted with shit. One stood at the edge of that bed looking down first at one head and then another and then another. That's what AIDS looked like, a gaunt head framed by a top sheet and a pillow, the sound of lungs rasping, struggling to survive their own expiation, the gaunt face unshaven. What was the point? Head hair, what was left of it, thinning and damp, plastered against that white pillow as eyes rolled in the back of sockets. What was that movie expression? Let me see the whites of your eyes. Or don't show me the whites of your eyes. Blood draining from your fingers. Did that mean giving up? Don't show me. I want God so much right now to tell me this isn't happening. In fact, I wasn't an eye standing at the edge of that hospital bed. I was too much ego in all this presence, especially because it was disappearing. Instead, I felt like one, as in one admired, one thought, one believed. One was an eye person, but in a third person. It was the only way to bear it, to remove oneself from the scene of humans being destroyed, their spirits pulverized. One had no right to be an eye in this form of bed, the damp head coughing, because this wasn't happening to one's eye, it was happening to the beloved. All of which is to say, I don't want to remember 1991, 1992, 1993, 1994, 1995, or 1996. In 1996, the late literary theorist E. Sedgwick edited a posthumous collection called Gary in Your Pocket, Stories and Notebooks of Gary Fisher. The scholar met the then burgeoning gay writer in the spring of 1987 when she was teaching a seminar in gay lesbian literature called Across Genders, Across Sexualities. In her memoir of the only black student in the course, Cedric writes, Gary's demeanor during the first few weeks of class neither alarmed nor reassured me. He was a light and sweet but oddly formidable presence. His station by the door and his silence seemed to make him a kind of allegory for the liminal, or an allegory for the proverbial spook sitting by the door. Gary Fisher was in love with and rushed toward being the only black man at the party, just as the black men I met, or rather didn't meet, in those East Village bars wanted to be held as the only black man in some other's arms. Gary Fisher was born in Bristol, Pennsylvania, June 10, 1961. He was the eldest child and only boy of Cornell and Virginia Fisher, who had three younger daughters. Cornell was a career officer, and the family lived variously in El Paso, North Carolina, and Dusseldorf before Gary graduated from Pine Forest Senior High School in Fayetteville, North Carolina. But Fisher never seemed to recover from his early years as a European. Upon his family's return from Germany, Fisher made a half-assed attempt to acclimate himself to the American racial values. In a diary entry dated February 14, 1978, he wrote, went to that silly Nelson County High School Monday and was enrolled. So far, I really hate it. I have to manipulate myself between being a black, hip, rebellious, honky hater and a whitish-speaking, sweet little black boy who runs errands for the teacher. It's driving me mad, worrying whether the blacks will accept me and whether I should become a honky hater like many of the blacks. So far, the only real person I can even say I'm acquainted with are Amy and some white guy named Troy. I want to leave. I wish I were in Germany. When he was 18, Fisher applied to and was accepted at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where he majored in English. On November 7th, 1979, he wrote in his diary, with all these white friends, I think in many ways I am white, or not the black stereotype that blacks and whites alike have of blacks. I like it. That's all that matters. And on Wednesday, November 25th, 1979, he wrote, I'm beginning to like Jean more and more. Seems like the girl is fairly wealthy and isn't just an ordinary nigger. Is that my prejudice showing? It was a life, and it went on and on. Only degradation could justify the awful, reasonable-sounding voice of his self-hatred. Here's a letter Gary Fisher wrote to his beloved tormentor. Dear sir, I am a fit, intelligent black slave with a keen desire to please. I'm 5'8", 145 pounds, 28 years old, strong, trim, naturally muscular, yet small enough to pose no real threat to you, which I expect you will demonstrate right away. I enjoy being overpowered by a big, horny man made to submit all his desire, though I'd be willing to do so without force. I'm a good cocksucker, well trained by two over-endowed masters, and find tremendous contentment and satisfaction in having my mouth and throat full of cock, like a child. I would gladly suck your cock all night long or any time and anywhere you see fit. I don't want to remember Eve Sedgwick's account of seeing Gary Fisher in 1991 after she had half a year of chemotherapy for the cancer that would eventually kill her. And Fisher had AIDS-related Kaposi. She had lost her hair, Sedgwick said, and that was a narcissistic insult. And yes, Gary said, he could understand. That's what he felt about his KS lesions on his arms. Nobody else ever saw them. He always wore long-sleeve shirts, he told her. But when he was alone, he said, in his apartment, he'd look at his insult for hours, standing in front of the mirror, unrecognizable to himself. Impaled by stigma. After Gary died of AIDS in 1993, Eve Sedgwick told one of Gary's sisters that story, and she said, I think that's how Gary experienced being black, too. I don't want to remember how I circled Gary Fisher's writing for years, and I read a bit here and there, and then put the book back on the shelf. I didn't want to love him, despite myself. But how could I not? He was part of the body that didn't recognize itself or want to recognize itself as such. Gary Fish was anxious to give up power, to have his voice stuffed by white cock and then forgotten. I lived in the white space of his reflection before I read his book straight through, and then I read it again. He was one of the black men who wouldn't look at me in those bars and elsewhere. What was the point? There was no value in our knowing one another. And yet he was teaching me something about the rents in my rainbow fabric, the rips in my idealized black body that was as much of a fiction as anything else. I don't want to remember that the black scholar Don Belton wrote the introduction to Gary in your pocket, and that is in his introduction he describes meeting Fisher through Sedgwick, and how Belton and Gary spoke on the telephone, and he read Gary's writing, and Gary seemed ambivalent about publishing his work, and Gary saying, where can a black queer sociopath get a fair hearing anyway? And how that reminded me of Carlos in our conversation. And then Belton goes on to talk about their love of pop divas and how Gary would talk about his sadomasochistic fantasies and how that frightened the older man. And how, just recently, I tried to find Don Belton to talk about all this, only to learn that the University of Indiana professor was murdered in 2009 by a straight white hustler he met on December 27th, 2 days after Christmas. And in the night, another thing I don't want to remember. Thank you. I think we have time for questions. I sort of edited a bit. There's this long section about Carlos and Alvin that you'll read when I finish writing. But I felt that it was important to talk about Gary because I really do love him more, and working on the show with wonderful people like Jenny and Alex, and meeting great people like Hal Sedgwick, who is Eve's widower, and finding out just little bits and talking to one of his sisters on the phone. I just think he's a significant writer in terms of counterbalancing the kind of Sontag-Bardian thing with a certain other kind of American racial reality that's, to me, in terms of writing, as significant as what these other people were doing. But it's because, in part, because his output was very small, relatively small to those people, that he's unknown. But I'm hoping, I went to San Francisco, and his papers, and you can all go at the New York Public Library, and they have this amazing gay history section, and his papers are there, and lots of photographs of him with various lovers, and he used to keep these very obsessive lists of song titles. So there's another kind of book that can really be done from his graphic work, and I'm just really feel really fortunate to come across his writing. It's unlike anything else, and I just have a love for him because anybody who can come up with a line like, where does a black gay sociopath get a fair hearing, is okay in my book. Definitely somebody I would want to have dinner with. And I think because of the time that I'm describing, when it was such a different world and so segregated in many ways, he didn't have a chance to kind of break out of that. And so it makes me love him more because he didn't have an opportunity. So that's one of the wonderful things about writing, is that you can make people live again and give them their say. And that's what's been amazing about this particular project at the Artist Institute is that so many fantastic people are getting their say. And I had a drink with a really great writer, Jennifer Kransky. Do you guys read her sometimes? And she said something about the plastic that I've been using in all of the shows, and how one of the artists who was helping me, Jared Burkheiser, is a great person. He said it always made him so sad because it was like quarantining people. And Jennifer said, yeah, and body bags. And it's just so fulfilling and, of course, emotionally wrenching that people are really understanding what I'm trying to do in all the shows, which is to really recall. I hate people being forgotten. It just makes me crazy. So I'm so grateful to Jenny and Alex for opening the space to kind of elegy for 6 months. And you can't have a really proper elegy without it being a party. And the party are the live people that are in the show, and young artists, and you. So there you go. Do you have any questions or anything you'd like to ask or complain about? want your money back, or you know that wonderful thing Billie Holiday used to say, which is what I'll close with, but she used to say, I thank you for your time and your money. Thank you.